Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Director's Box podcast. If you've listened to the first three, you'll know that I'm Kev, your host, and alongside me I've got Craig Gill as always. Craig, hope you've had a good week, mate.
Hi, Kevin. Yes, I've had a great week, thank you. I've been celebrating my 60th birthday, as I mentioned last week. So, yeah, been great to celebrate that with some of the family and friends out here in the USA. So, yeah, it's been a busy week, but a very enjoyable one.
Been a busy week of football as well, Craig, and we're going to cover lots of that over the next 30 to 40 minutes or so. So coming up in this fourth podcast, we are going to take our first look at the Scottish Premiership. We promised that we would go north of the border. We'll do that this week, and we'll discuss the top and the bottom of that league. Craig and myself will pick out a couple of things that we noticed from the EFL divisions over the course of the weekend, and then we'll have a look at the way that the Premier League title race is shaping up, particularly in light of a huge game of football on Sunday afternoon between Liverpool and Manchester City at Anfield, a game that we'll have a little bit of a deeper look into. And then we'll finish off this podcast by looking at maybe the early runners and riders for the PFA Player of the Season Award. Obviously, we're getting to the sort of time where the voting ballots get handed out and the votes are made and things. So we'll have a look at who could possibly be in line with that. Before we discuss that, though, a little bit of trivia for you just to rack your brains about whilst we get into that stage. Only four Arsenal players have ever won the PFA Player of the Season Award, which is quite surprising when you consider how dominant Arsenal have been in the sort of 40 to 45 years that it's been going on. So listen, and whilst you're listening, just see if you can get those four, and I'll reveal them all when we get down to the PFA Player of the Season part of the podcast. No prizes, but we'll give you all a special virtual point if you can get all four. Very difficult, I think, but we shall find out. And I'll see if Craig knows any of them when we get down there as well. I've just thrown this on to him, so we'll see how good his memory is. But before we get there, Craig, let's start with the Scottish Premiership, where, incredibly, for the first time in 6 years, both Celtic and Rangers lost on the same weekend, the weekend just gone. That's absolutely incredible, isn't it?
Well, it was, wasn't it? You know, and given, obviously, how tight it is at the top as well, you would have thought that maybe, you know, if either team had taken 3 points from their, you know, their respective game, then obviously, you know, it would have changed the whole outlook on the at the top of the SPL. Yeah, but with obviously Rangers and Celtic losing, it's still a 2-point deficit at the top with Rangers leading at the moment. But of course, an Old Firm game coming up in the not too distant future. Yeah, it all makes for an exciting time at the top of the SPL. As we said, it was at the top of the Premier League and the EFLs as well.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I mean, for Rangers to lose, first and foremost, that was a bit of a surprise because they've been in really, really sort of hot form. They looked like they were going to sort of pull away a little bit, really. Not the case, though. Celtic had their chance to overtake them on Sunday, fluff their lines, albeit you have to say that they lost to a Hearts side who were third in the table, and they look third in the table on merit. So that's certainly not a terrible result for Brendan Rodgers' men in any way, shape or form. But yeah, this with Celtic sort of 13 points ahead of Hearts, and we're getting to the kind of closing stages of the season now, that part where the division splits into two. It's looking like that Old Firm game, or the two Old Firm games that will eventually come, are going to decide which way the title goes, Craig.
Yeah, as you say, you know, Rangers, first of all, losing against at home as well against Motherwell 2-1. That was a shock result, without a shadow of a doubt. And then, of course, then the following day, as you say, you know, Celtic going to Hearts and losing 2-0 in Edinburgh. So, very uncharacteristic, like results, if you like, for the Old Firm pair. And of course, looking at the table, as we said, you know, Rangers are 2 points clear of Celtic. That same game's played, 29. Hearts in third, 55 points. And St Mirren in fourth on 42. It's quite amazing, really, isn't it, to think that, you know, when Philippe Clement was appointed back in October, that Rangers were 7 points behind Celtic. And now they find themselves 2 points ahead. So that 9-point shift, it's quite remarkable, really, and testament to the work that Clement has done with that Rangers squad. Also, You know, if you consider the opposite, obviously, you know, the falling form of Celtic under Brendan Rodgers' managership. It all makes for an exciting end to the season, as we said. And, you know, I'm sure with Brendan Rodgers' experience and knowledge and expertise, I'm sure it's going to go right to the wire, I'm sure.
Yes, certainly looks that way. Sunday, April the 7th, it is the next Old Firm game at Ibrox. So Celtic could have quite a bit of work to do in that game in order to get themselves back in front in the title race. Rangers really are surging at the moment up there and looking very, very good under Philippe Clement, it has to be said. Certainly, they've certainly recovered from the sort of dodgy start that they had under Michael Beale, who's... reputation hasn't done any favours with his sort of stint at Sunderland that also failed, but they look like they've got the man who's got them rejuvenated now and sort of pushing for the title.
Yeah, he's certainly galvanised them, hasn't he, since October, and obviously that's been proven in their performances and their results. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see you know, how that Old Firm game goes now at the beginning of April. As you say, the league splits, and then of course then you've got the final Old Firm game then before the end of the season as well. So yeah, it really is on a knife edge, and again one which no doubt we'll be keeping a keen eye on.
We absolutely will. Yep. You mentioned St Mirren there just a moment ago. They had an incredible win at the weekend against Aberdeen. Not so much the fact that they beat Aberdeen, but the fact that they scored two goals late into injury time to do it. Aberdeen are an interesting one, Craig, because they obviously parted ways with their manager in January. They've appointed Neil Warnock as, although they call it, an interim manager until the end of the season. Certainly not a move that's worked. I have a lot of time for Neil Warnock. He wants to keep on working well into his 70s, and that's his right and things. But what do Aberdeen stand to gain from having Neil Warnock as manager until the end of the season? He's clearly not going to be there in any stage next season. They were in no real danger of being relegated when he arrived. I mean, that's not necessarily the case now because the form since he's arrived has been terrible. But surely they would have been sort of much better off appointing someone for the future and giving them this time to find out what he's got at his disposal, rather than just bringing in a, for the want of a better phrase, a journeyman who's never been to the Scottish Premier League before, just for 6 months, just to steady the ship and tide it over, really. I don't really see, other than Neil Warnock's bank balance, I don't really see who gains from that move.
Well, unless, of course, the board thought that they were in some jeopardy. You know, looking at the table now, Aberdeen sit 4 points above Ross County in 10th, Ross County 11th, obviously, and Livingston at the bottom on 17th, who unfortunately appear to be almost relegated already, but obviously a lot of points still to play for. You can look at first of all, let's take that St Mirren result into account, because two goals in 76 seconds, you know, so I'm sure the fans must have been thinking, you know, 1-0 down, they must have been thinking, oh, well, that's us gone another Saturday afternoon where we've not taken the points, and then 76 seconds later they've taken the 3 points and going home with a smile on their face. So an interesting turnaround of affairs there, as you said, with the St Mirren game. Going back to Aberdeen and Neil Warnock, who knows what club owners and boards of directors, chairman think sometimes, but by the same token, you know, let's give full credit to Neil Warnock and his experiences, his knowledge, again, and his leadership style. You know, I know he's been successful in the majority of clubs that he's managed at. I think he's got the record for a number of promotions from the Championship into the Premier League, I believe, or certainly the record number of promotions in the Football League. And maybe they wanted someone just to ensure that, you know, they do avoid any potential of, you know, a relegation dogfight. That could have been it, because obviously he has proven himself to be successful in those circumstances with other clubs in England. And maybe they wanted someone with that experience to have a look at the overall situation at the club. You know, obviously a football club, you know, it goes far deeper than just the first team. You know, it's the whole youth development side, you know, academy, you know, the training facilities, the staff members, the way things work on a daily and weekly basis. So maybe, you know, they might have brought him in not only on a managerial appointment, but maybe almost on a director of football piece, really, where, you know, they wanted him to perhaps look at the running of the football club as a whole. I don't know. I'm just surmising, but I can see perhaps why Aberdeen have brought him in, and it'll be interesting to see how Aberdeen fare now, you know, from now until the end of the season. As I said, only 4 points above that second relegation playoff place. So, yeah, that'll be another interesting one to keep an eye on.
It will indeed, yeah. The one thing Warnock has got sort of on his side is he's very, very good at getting clubs out of danger. He did it with Huddersfield last season in the Championship when they were dead and buried, or everyone thought they were dead and buried. He kept them up. No games in Scotland this weekend, at least in terms of the Premier League, but Aberdeen do have their game in hand against Dundee next Wednesday. And then that follows with a trip to Motherwell on the following Saturday. So two huge journeys against sides that are going to be in that lower half with them to come. So it'll be interesting to see just how Aberdeen do there. And I suppose we should just finish this Scottish Premiership bit with just kudos to St Mirren. They're not one of the biggest sides in the Scottish Premier League by any stretch of the imagination. So to be fourth currently, sort of heading up the best of the rest, if you will, if you say that Rangers, Celtic and Hearts are a little bit clear of the rest, that's a fantastic achievement.
Oh, it certainly is. Yeah. You know, as I said, you know, there are other teams, no doubt, with bigger budgets, I would imagine. Obviously not knowing what St Mirren's budget is, but if you look at, you know, history and pedigree, if you like, you know, from the teams around them, then St Mirren certainly are doing a great job. And, you know, full credit to them for that.
Yeah, Stephen Robinson, their manager, the former Motherwell manager, used to play for Luton back in the early 2000s. So good to see a good guy doing well at St Mirren. Okay, let's move away from Scotland then and go back into the EFL. We covered the EFL top to bottom last week and we highlighted just how good all three divisions are going to be over the remainder of the season, and some brilliant moments again at the weekend, Craig. I think my favourite moment amongst them was seeing the scenes at the end of the AFC Wimbledon versus Milton Keynes Dons game in League Two. AFC Wimbledon, we all know what happened between those two clubs sort of back in the 90s, early 2000s, where Wimbledon was relocated to Milton Keynes. They took over the sort of Wimbledon as was, leaving AFC Wimbledon to reform and reform well. And whenever these two clubs meet, it's always a huge occasion. And it needed a 94th minute winner for AFC Wimbledon at Plough Lane. And it was scored in front of the AFC Wimbledon fans. The place just went nuts. It was the kind of thing that if you was an AFC Wimbledon fan, you're just going to remember for 10, 20 years or more. And you just love to have been in that home end that day. It's the kind of thing that, given that all they've been through in the past with this opposition club, to beat them in the 94th minute and obviously sort of put a little bit of a dent in Milton Keynes' promotion charge, that must have been very, very satisfying for AFC Wimbledon.
Without a shadow of a doubt, Kevin. Yeah, obviously, the rivalry between these two clubs, as you've already mentioned, is rife. Obviously, MK Dons taking on the Wimbledon name initially. Obviously, the Dons coming from Wimbledon. And then taking the club lock, stock and barrel over to Milton Keynes. Then subsequently building a brand new state-of-the-art stadium, you know, which has also featured in World Cup bids when England have bid for World Cups and European Championships. The MK Dons Stadium has featured as one of the targeted stadiums to hold games at the highest level. But more than that, you know, them taking Wimbledon's history, like if you like, for to a certain degree, would not have left a great taste in the mouth for diehard Wimbledon fans. Obviously, since then, Wimbledon have reinvented themselves, if you like, or certainly re-established themselves as AFC Wimbledon, have come back through the non-league system. I remember watching them play at Kingstonians ground several years ago. And it's great to see them now back at Plough Lane with their own purpose-built stadium and actually, you know, really competing well, sitting in 10th position at the moment in League Two. So, yeah, as you say, that 94th minute winner by Ronnie Curtis must have been just you know, music to the ears, and so sweet for those Wimbledon fans after all they've suffered over the years at the hands of MK Dons.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I've seen sort of clips of the winner on social media and things, and the fans behind that goal are going mental. All the substitutes run into the corner where the celebrations are taking place. It's just one of those moments that, yeah, you can only sort of smile and be happy for AFC Wimbledon, really. As a Luton fan, they gave me my darkest day when they beat Luton on penalties in the playoff final in the National League in 2011. We had to go all the way to Man City for that game because Wembley was being used for the Champions League final. We lost on penalties to Wimbledon, and yeah, horrible, horrible day. But it's hard not to feel a sense of sort of pleasure with AFC Wimbledon, particularly in light of everything that's happened to them. So yeah, that was my moment of the weekend in the EFL, Craig. Did anything stand out for you in particular?
One aspect that we spoke about last week, Kevin, was Nathan Jones taking over at Charlton Athletic. Obviously, Charlton struggling towards the lower ends of League One. And I think since Nathan Jones has gone in, I think they're unbeaten in six. They got a point at Northampton Town at the weekend, 1-1 draw there. And then they beat Charlton Town 3-1 on Tuesday night. So, yeah, Nathan Jones is certainly changing the fortunes there at Charlton Athletic. And I had the pleasure of playing with Nathan Jones when we were much, much younger, both of us, at Merthyr Tydfil, where Merthyr Tydfil were in the conference. But that was, that was a long, long time ago. But that's my only sort of interaction with Nathan. But yeah, he's doing a great job at Charlton Athletic. And I just thought I would mention that of note. His performances and their performances, I think, have taken them from, you know, very close, precariously to in and around the relegation zone. They're now 7 points ahead of that in 14th place on 41 points. Cheltenham occupying the last of those relegation slots on 34 points, having paid 35, yeah, two games less. So, yeah, you've done a great job, and no doubt we'll be keeping an eye on Charlton Athletic's fortunes from now to the end of the season.
Yeah, he's a man I know very well, having managed Luton in two different spells recently. Still stay in contact with him now. Completely different man away from a football pitch or a football sideline than he is close to a football sideline. But I had no doubt whatsoever that he would do very well at Charlton. He came through the coaching ranks at Charlton before he came to Luton. So it's a club that he knows well. They know him well. And it just seems like a perfect match, much in the same way that Luton and Nathan Jones were as they were coming through the league. So this season might be a little bit too deep in the sort of campaign for him to do anything in terms of getting Charlton out of League One towards the Championship. But I would not be surprised if at some stage in the stage of what was a 4.5-year deal when he took over at the Valley, if he has Charlton Athletic moving upwards in divisions rather than the downwards that they were looking at the time that he was appointed. We'll finish off this EFL chat then, Craig, with a look at the Championship. And the thing that stood out to me in the Championship at the weekend was the match at St Andrews between Birmingham City and Southampton. I don't know what it is about Southampton, but they're enough like a high-scoring game this lot. And they played to form again on Saturday. Birmingham 3, Southampton 4. 96th minute winner this time for Southampton, who really had to win because they'd already seen a couple of sort of teams in and around the sort of promotion shake-up already win. So it was a massive, massive result for Russell Martin and his men. Real hammer blow for Birmingham City, actually, who, from all the highlights that I saw, it was the extended game on the highlights programme over in the UK. They looked really good, Birmingham, for large parts, but a late sending off really hit them. And he just kind of felt that they were never going to hang on. And in the end, they couldn't. And as I say, last minute winner from Joe Aribo to send Southampton to a massive, massive 3 points that keeps them clinging to the coattails of the likes of Leicester, Ipswich and Leeds in that fascinating Championship promotion race.
Yeah, as you say, Sanderson getting sent off in the 67th minute seems to have been the turning point, really. At that stage, Southampton were 3-2 up, but remarkably, with 10 men, Birmingham came back to equalise through Bakuna in the 77th minute. And then Aribo, as you said, popped up with a winner in the 96th minute. So certainly leaving it late, Southampton. But, they're going to be competitive. You know, Russell Martin, I know from his days at Swansea, likes to play sort of, you know, pure football, if you like, playing out from the back, playing through the thirds. Very much a possession-based coach. And it seems to have been paying dividends this season for Southampton, certainly. And where are they now? They're fourth in the league on 70 points, 35 games played. In fact, all the top teams now have played 35 points, all the way down to 13th. So Southampton on 70 points. Yeah, it's again, we spoke about it last week, Kevin. It's really, really tight up there, isn't it? And those top four clubs, it really is. I think it's going to go to the wire. I think we mentioned only a few weeks ago that I think Leicester, didn't they have a huge margin at one stage, maybe 11 or 9 points clear. And it just shows how quickly, you know, the tables can change because the championship is so competitive, you know, and teams are taking points off each other. And yeah, you take your eye off the table for 1 minute and it changes, you know, from game to game.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. Southampton, not the only one scoring late goals. Ipswich on Tuesday night needed a very, very late goal to see off Bristol City in another really, really good game of championship football. The one thing you're guaranteed in the championship, it doesn't matter which two teams, maybe with the exception of Rotherham, no disrespect to them. But whichever two teams you put in against each other, you're going to get a competitive game of football. And we're seeing a lot of that at the moment. Incidentally, at the bottom end of the table, Sheffield Wednesday have won 5 of their last 6 games, and they've gone from 23rd to 23rd. It's incredible, isn't it? You'd have thought with a run, given how tight the championship is at the bottom end of the table, as we reflected on last week, 5 wins in 6 would shoot you well up the table. But unfortunately for the Owls, every single time they win, every team around them wins and they can't make no progress. And they'll be hoping to come out of the sort of bottom three at the weekend. But it is so tight. I mean, we highlighted it last week, how tight it is. It got even tighter over the weekend. We've got your sort of team, Swansea, who are probably top of this sort of list now on 42 points, 15th place in the table. But they're only 4 points ahead of Sheffield Wednesday, who were second from bottom. It's absolutely crazy. Just Plymouth and Stoke in that gap. Lost at the weekend, or sorry, midweek, should I say. And everyone else is picking up points down there. It's a real battle to avoid the drop in the championship. We said it last week. We'll probably say it on every podcast, but I just feel a bit sorry for Sheffield Wednesday. They went 5 of their last 6 and they've not gone anywhere.
Absolutely. It's remarkable, isn't it? To have won, you know, 4 games on the bounce and not to have moved at the table just goes to show what, you know, what a precarious position they were in before those wins. And as you say, you know, you've got Sheffield Wednesday 23rd on 38 points, and you can go up to Swansea, you mentioned, 15th on 42 points, and even, you know, as high as Watford, who are in 12th position, they're on 44 points. So there's only 6 points, you know, separating 12th position all the way down to 23rd. So that's effectively, it's not obviously on paper because other teams win, but, you know, it's a 6 points, 2 wins, you know, and it's just, we thought the top four was tight, but I mean, if you look at the bottom, you know, the bottom 12, it's even tighter. So that championship is really is an exciting league. And I keep saying it, but no doubt there'll be many, many more twists and turns to come between now and the end of the season. And
really,
it could well be that teams who are mid-table now and supposedly, in inverted commas, comfortable, find themselves dragged into that relegation battle quite quickly with a couple of poor results.
It's definitely not the time for a mid-table team to go on a bad run of form, that's for sure. It's music to my ears, actually, Craig, that you included Watford in that list as a Luton fan.
I thought you might mention them, Kevin, yeah.
To have them looking down rather than up, that's very much music to my ears. Speaking of Luton, let's go to the Premier League to conclude our look at the sort of football action on this episode, Craig. We'll focus more on the top, actually, because there is a huge game of football on Sunday afternoon. But before we get to that, 3 games at the weekend just gone. 3 very different wins for Liverpool, Manchester City and Arsenal. Liverpool needed the latest of all late winners, and controversial at that, to see off Nottingham Forest after the referee dropped the ball in the wrong place a couple of minutes before the Liverpool winner. Manchester City had to come from behind against Manchester United, but they did so with Phil Foden on particular hot form. And then Arsenal just blew a almost out of their depth Sheffield United away on Monday night, winning 6-0, being 5-0 up at half time. And at which point you thought all kinds of records were in danger in that game. We'll start with the Liverpool game first. Obviously, Narrowest win of the three, but when you consider the amount of players they had out injured and the fact that they were away from home at an awkward Nottingham Forest, they're the kind of wins that make you think, core, they're really in the title race here. It probably makes the other two think, oh, heck, we thought they were dropping points and they're not. And it kind of just psychologically, you think Liverpool got one up on them there.
Yeah, well, I watched the last 10 minutes of that game actually, and it was. I can't obviously comment on the previous 90 minutes, but the last 10 minutes was, you know, it was certainly nail biting from a Liverpool fan's perspective, I would imagine. Nunes obviously popping up with a winner in the 99th minute after a great reverse ball by McAllister from the edge of the box just to dink it in the air into the far post. And fair play to Nunes, you know, finishing well into the bottom corner with a header. But yes, as you say, you know, it just goes to show the resilience in this Liverpool squad, I think, that they're able to, you know, to keep going and to dig in and to get those 3 points so late in the game. It looked as if, you know, Forest were going to go away with potentially well-earned point.
Yeah, it did. Credit to Darwin Nunez, came off the bench. He was the one when that cross came in. He knew where it was going. He was the one attacking it, whereas the defenders were kind of sort of almost nonplussed, really, and they were just sort of labouring out and trying to play him offside. They never got anywhere near it, and a lovely finish. And yeah, that put Liverpool, well, 4 points clear at one stage, but Manchester City answered. I have to say, before Manchester City did answer, though, Marcus Rashford scored one of the goals of the season to open the scoring in that game. Well, they always look better when they go in off the crossbar, don't they? But I think it come out of nowhere, and absolute wonder strike. But all it did ultimately was wake Manchester City up and sort of poke the bear. And for the rest of that game, it was a case of could Man United hold out? They couldn't. Phil Foden replied with an equally good goal to level the scoring. And then once it got to 1-1, Manchester City always felt like they were going to win from there.
Yeah, what a great goal, wasn't it? By Rashford, a great strike. And they showed an angle of it from behind the Manchester United goal line. And you see him, you know, step onto the onto the layoff, and he just hits it, you know, with great force. What a great strike! Yeah, and of course that went, you know, against everybody's predictions. You know, Man United taking the lead, and then as you say, probably did poke the bear. But typically, with Manchester City, they capture the game plan, possession with patience, but with a purpose, obviously, as is the Guardiola way. Interesting to see Manchester United set up the way they did. They played almost with a very, very narrow four midfield, almost like a boxing midfield, which other clubs have played. In fact, Manchester City have played it, to their credit. But this was more of a defensive nature. So they very much tried to stop Manchester City playing through and breaking lines by condensing that midfield area. And as you say, first half, they were very successful in doing so. But typically, I noticed certainly in the first 15 minutes, Manchester United had more possession probably than they did in the whole of the first half. Now, whether that was a ploy and Manchester City just sat off them a little bit, but what it did allow in transition then, where those lines were really tight and those spaces were really tight between the units in the first half, Manchester City were then able to play through Man United and get more success, and obviously that's where the goals came. So yeah, Man City sticking to the game plan, being patient in possession, moving Manchester United around. Great credit to Manchester United for their defensive organisation resilience, but I think the qualities of Manchester City shone through, especially with the Phil Foden goal cutting inside on his left foot and hammer it into the top left-hand corner.
Yeah, I'm glad Pep gave him the FA Cup game off the week before, because De Bruyne and Haaland did enough damage without him being on the pitch as well. He does look some talent, Phil Foden, that's for sure. So that left Arsenal, who I still think, or I've kind of thought throughout, are the sort of third-choice team in this title race, but they're not going away. And actually, all of a sudden, they are coming seriously strong with the amount of goals that they're scoring. And for all that Sheffield United were terrible on Monday night, you still have to beat what's in front of you. And Arsenal, in that first half in particular, were absolutely ruthless. And then, of course, Mikel Arteta used the second half to make a number of changes and rest players ahead of their game against Brentford this coming weekend. But They're not going away without a fight, are they, Arsenal? And these goals, the amount of goals that they're scoring, coupled with the so few goals that they're conceding, if there is a slip up from the top two, and they're guaranteed to be dropped points from one of them this weekend, they're in position to take advantage now, Arsenal.
Yes, they are. And, you know, their goal scoring of late is quite remarkable. And I saw a stat at the weekend, I think, which said in this calendar year, so January, February, they've scored 31 goals and conceded three. So, you know, that's some stat, obviously. And it's indicative of the way that Arteta has set up. Very much a front foot team, obviously. And, you know, just to look at this month, just look at February, I should say, just gone. Obviously, the 3-1 win over Liverpool, the 6-0 win at the London Stadium against West Ham, 5-0 at Burnley. And then obviously the 4-1 win at home against Newcastle, and then followed up then obviously with a 6-0 win at Sheffield United last weekend. So they, you know, they're in a great goal scoring form, and maybe with the momentum that they're carrying on, maybe they'll be the team to keep an eye on. We said they're in third, and they look as if the team that's got to do the catch up. But maybe with their momentum, you know, maybe they are the team to keep an eye on, and maybe they will be the team that come to the fore doing the running.
The one thing they've done in this run that you just quite rightly highlighted, 31 goals scored, three against, their goal difference has overtaken the other two. Now, if that does come into play over the remainder of the season, then they've done themselves a real favour there. And that, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? The other two struggling with injuries at earlier parts of the season and things like that, their goal difference, while still good, it's going to take something to sort of catch Arsenal in terms of goal difference if that does come into play. So that will be really, really interesting. It's, and the other thing, all of these goals have come off the back of everyone saying they needed to sign a striker in January. Well, clearly Mikel Arteta knew best, because they're all coming along with sort of Kai Havertz as a false nine, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Havertz, obviously Martinez as well. And just look at, talking about the goal difference, Kevin, is quite marked actually, because, you know, Arsenal in third, obviously they've all played 27 games now, they've all equaled out as far as fixtures are concerned. So Arsenal third on 61 points, Manchester City second on 62, and Liverpool top obviously on 63. But actually, if you look at the goal difference, Arsenal are plus 45, and they're 10 goals better off than Manchester City on plus 35, and Liverpool are on plus 39. So who knows? You know, if it goes that tight, that goal difference could play a major part. You know, with only 2 points separating the three teams at the moment, goal difference could play a major part come the end of the season.
And Arsenal have the chance to go top of the league on Saturday evening when they take on Brentford at the Emirates Stadium. So if they win that game, that really piles the pressure on both Liverpool and Manchester City for that huge clash at Anfield on Sunday, Craig. Where are we in terms of the title race now? Are we looking at that as Manchester City must win, Manchester City can't lose? Is it a must win for Liverpool, given that Arsenal could be ahead of them by the time this game kicks off? How do you sort of see the result of that game? Who's it a bigger game for? I guess Liverpool being at home is probably bigger for them, but Manchester City just can't afford to slip up now.
Absolutely. I think, well, obviously, with it being at Anfield, you would say that maybe the bigger pressure is on Liverpool, because obviously, you know, they want to do well at home. But I just think that, you know, the quality of the three sides at the top, you know, we talk about this weekend results being important. Of course they are. But again, you know, we've seen it already. You know, the twists and turns of many games to come still. Yes, this weekend's games are important. And, you know, if you're a Liverpool fan, you want to be taking 3 points. Would both teams settle for a point each now? Who knows? Possibly not. And as you say, with Arsenal maybe getting the win in the earlier game, then on the Saturday, obviously that would take them to 64. That would take them above both Liverpool and Manchester City. Yes, the games this weekend are important, clearly, and all three teams want to take maximum points for all the games they've got left. So I think that I don't know. I can see Liverpool just edging Manchester City in this one. Don't ask me why. I think home advantage. I think the whole event, you know, pressures will be on Manchester City, obviously, to go there and try and get at least a point. I can see Liverpool edging that one, perhaps by the odd goal. Arsenal winning their game. That would make interesting then, because that would then drop Manchester City potentially to third. And then again, it just opens up the whole race again, doesn't it? But I think this is going to go right to the wire. I think this whole Premier League title decider is going to go right the way to the end. And albeit, you know, Sunday's game is huge. Yeah, I think they're going to keep us occupied from now right the way through to the end of the season, Kevin.
Yeah, they are. And last day of March, the next game for Manchester City in the Premier League after Liverpool is Manchester City against Arsenal. So the next few weeks are going to tell us an awful lot in the Premier League title race. Whoever wins the title, Craig, whoever it may be, are likely to have the PFA Player of the Season in their ranks. Usually that generally is the case. The last six seasons, this award has been dominated by Liverpool and Manchester City players. Mo Salah, Erling Haaland, Kevin De Bruyne got their hands on this. And the sort of odds for it this year would have Manchester City and Liverpool players as favourites. But as I mentioned right at the start of this podcast, only four Arsenal players have ever won the PFA Player of the Year award. Do you know how many of those four?
I would be guessing. I would imagine at some stage Thierry Henry probably would have won it.
Won it twice, yeah.
Tony Adams, perhaps?
Not Tony Adams, no.
Okay. Dennis Bergkamp?
Dennis Bergkamp, yep, he's the second one.
Yeah, and I'm just clutching at straws now. You put me out of my misery, Kevin, you tell me.
I'll put everyone out of their misery. I think people, certainly Arsenal fans of the most recent generation, will have had Robin van Persie written down. He had a brilliant season for them. So those three, I think, were findable. You have to go quite a way back for the other one though, Craig.
I'm gonna go Charlie Nicholas,
who was of a similar era, but it was 78-79. Liam Brady was the PFA Player of the Season that year. That's your fourth master player.
Wonderful left foot,
absolutely majestic left peg. Yeah, could we have an Arsenal player win it this year?
Well, I'm just going back to Charlie Nicholas, actually. I think, I'm not sure if he might have won the young PFA Young Player of the Year maybe one year, but his name rings a bell with one of those two awards anyway. Obviously not the main one, so maybe back in the day he might have won the Young Player of the Year award. But yeah, interesting. Who knows? Well, I think Martin Odegaard is certainly putting his claim forward for it. He's really impressed me the way he leads that midfield and obviously plays in a higher role as well, and he's also come up with some great goals as well. So I think he's been a massive influence for Arsenal this season. So I think he would be certainly a contender. And the other one that I've got highlighted for this award is not De Bruyne, and although I'm sure you'll feature or Haaland, but I think Phil Foden has been instrumental for Manchester City this season, and not only his performances, but he's come up with some great goals as well.
Yeah, he has. Foden actually second favourite with the bookmakers for that award at the moment, behind Rodri of Manchester City. I think that's largely down to the fact that he missed all three of Manchester City's defeats this season, rather than anything that he's caught the eye with, although he's a wonderful talent. I mean, Phil Foden showed exactly why people rate him so highly in the Manchester derby at the weekend. If Liverpool do go on and win the league, of course, Mo Salah would be right there, but he's had an awful lot of injuries, hasn't he, in recent times, Mo Salah, although he is in the squad for the Europa League game on Thursday night, so he may well feature against Manchester City at the weekend. But maybe Virgil van Dijk would be more fitting winner. He's already scored the winner in the cup final. Seems to pop up whenever Liverpool need him to pop up, as I found out to my cost when I was at Anfield 3 weeks ago. Captain of that side as well. So if Liverpool do go on and win the Premier League, perhaps rather than Mo Salah being the player of the year, maybe they'll look further back to the colossus that is Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah, he's a huge player for them, isn't he? You know, he's a rock in that central defence. A great leader, obviously, and as you say, popped up with a winner in the Carabao Cup final as well. So I think that could be a very good call, and I'm sure he'll be in contention as well come the end of the season.
He will indeed. Yeah, Just incidentally, there's just one player outside of Liverpool, Manchester City, and Arsenal in the top 10 of the current bookmakers' odds for this award. And unfortunately, I saw him firsthand on Saturday evening, and that's Ollie Watkins, who does deserve a mention in this, Craig, because he's got 16 goals, 10 assists this season in just the Premier League. He's having a phenomenal season. He scored twice against Luton at the weekend. Header from a set piece, and then a wonderful sort of intuitive sort of move from a free kick with a brilliant first touch and a curling finish that reminded me of Thierry Henry, actually, speaking of him. 16 goals and 10 assists, 26 goal contributions for a side like Aston Villa, who are fourth in the table. He's largely the reason why they're fourth in the table. So he deserves a mention when this award comes about.
Absolutely. I mean, the job that Unai Emery has done there at Aston Villa is phenomenal, really. And full testament to his coaching ability. But of course, he's proven that over the years, particularly at Seville. Ollie Watkins, you know, has been a breath of fresh air, hasn't he? You know, a great signing by Aston Villa from Brentford, where obviously he first came to real note, if you like. And of course, with the Euros coming up in the summer, you know, he's been touted as sort of second striker to Harry Kane. And you can only see more exciting things, you know, in the future for Ollie Watkins. And, you know, dare I say, a move to a bigger club, that would be an insult, obviously, to Aston Villa, because they are a huge club. But, you know, who knows what the future holds for Ollie Watkins. But if he continues, you know, in the form that he's shown this season, you know, it's extremely bright.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic campaign for Ollie Watkins, which will surely be rewarded with a space on the plane in Gareth Southgate's Euro 2024 squad come the summer. So you're saying sort of Odegaard or Foden right now for this award, Craig. I think I would lean in the direction of Foden as well, actually. When he was at Kenilworth Road for the league game earlier in the season, he had feet that I've never seen before. He just dazzled. And as I said a minute ago, I'm more than happy that he sat on the bench and watched the cup game, else that could have got even nastier than it did. I just think he's a special talent. And if Manchester City do go on and win the league, he's going to have plenty more big moments to play within that. And I also like the way that Pep has treated him, Craig. He kind of eased him in gently, didn't he? And there was a clamour within the English media that he should be playing every week, or why isn't he playing every week? And Pep knew best, and now he is playing more regularly and he's got the best out of him, and credit to coach and player in that regard.
Yes, Kevin, you're right. And I think Pep has always said that Phil Foden is going to be a special player. Even when he first burst onto the scene, he said, you know, this guy is going to be a special player. And so it's been proven, and he's still so young as well, of course, and he's got so much more to achieve yet. But yeah, this season he's really caught my eye, and as you say, his great movement, you know, great feet, as you said, you know, great technical ability in tight areas, particularly, and a great finish to boot as well, as he proved, with that goal against Manchester United the weekend.
Yeah, real standout talent, and if I was a player or a member of the PFA, that would be where my vote would be going. That's almost it for this episode of the podcast. Just before we go, I just want to say a huge thank you to Bournemouth fans, actually, Craig. The football family kind of comes together, doesn't it, when one of its own is sort of in difficulty. And next Wednesday is the rescheduled game between Bournemouth and Luton, which was obviously halted after an hour back in December when Tom Lockyer collapsed with a cardiac arrest. Bournemouth fans have rallied amongst themselves and they've raised money for all Luton fans to go to the rearranged game at the Vitality Stadium by coach. They're going to pay for all of the coach travel for Luton fans, which they didn't have to do. They've gone out of their way to do that. So as a Luton fan, on behalf of all my fellow Luton fans who will be taking up that option, I extend a warm gratitude to their fans for raising that money, and also the way that Bournemouth as a club have handled the whole situation. Anyone who had a ticket to the original games getting into this game, this rearranged game, free of charge. Again, that didn't need to happen, but that's a nice thing to do. And the two clubs have just come together at a time where, you know, the need was beyond football, really, and just showing how good football can be.
It's a fantastic gesture, isn't it, Kevin, by Bournemouth, you know, and And he said, you know, sometimes football, you know, they call it the beautiful game, but it can be an ugly industry as well at times. But I just think that that gesture by Bournemouth really tells you what football is about, really, you know, deep down, in that people do care, not only for their own club, but they care about people in the game as well at large. And that's a fantastic gesture by Bournemouth in recognising the situation with Tom Lockyer. And obviously we all hope that Tom is recovering and rehabilitating well, obviously.
Indeed, yeah. Sure to be an emotional night next Wednesday at the Vitality Stadium. And yeah, thanks to everyone at Bournemouth for everything that they've done with regards to Luton fans. That is it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We hope that you're enjoying these podcasts. They're going to come at you every single week and we'll keep on going even during the international break that comes up. Craig, have you got anything on the horizon this weekend? It's Crystal Palace versus Luton for me at Selhurst Park. The archetype six-pointer is in terms of Luton. It's a game that we really, really need to win. And then I'll be off to the Vitality Stadium next Wednesday for the Bournemouth game. But how's your week looking?
Yeah, it's my son Daniel's 18th birthday tomorrow, actually. So we'll be celebrating that with family and friends out here. So we've actually got a joint 60th and 18th birthday gathering. So we're very much looking forward to that. On the football front, obviously, I'll be watching all things from across the pond. And yeah, you know, I'll be keeping an eye particularly on your Luton Town against Crystal Palace game, Kevin.
Fingers crossed for the Hatters at Selhurst Park. Obviously, if you're an Eagles fan, completely understand if you're exactly the opposite. If you are going to a football match this weekend, do enjoy it. Have fun, have a great time. Try and replicate those scenes of the AFC Wimbledon game that we spoke about earlier on in the podcast. But more importantly than anything, enjoy the game and be respectful to those around you. We will be back next week from myself and Craig. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.